Labor and Commerce to order. It's March 24th. It's 10 after 2. And thanks to Senator Davis and Senator Stevens for joining us. Senator Seacon and Ellis are excused, and I'm Senator Bundy, and we are covering today SB 137 and 140, both previously heard bills that we'll bring up for consideration, a new bill, SB 2, lien requirements, and then we'll continue public testimony on SB 130, workers' comp. So with that, SB 137, do we have some of the last person from the bill sponsor who's still in the building?
The bill passes out of committee and nobody's in the building. Does the bill still pass?
Yeah.
Members of the committee, Chairman Bundy, for letting me testify today. Once again,
identify yourself for the record.
My name is Joe Michelle, legislative aide to Senator Ralph Seacons. As I testified on Tuesday, March 22nd, regarding SB 137, the university and certain other institutions are exempt under the Uniform Resident Landlord-Tenant Act under AS 3403-330. Exempt institutions include hospital, nursing homes, schools, and counseling centers. Despite this exemption, lower court decisions have interpreted the statutes governing evictions to require a court action to evict a resident that refuses to leave one of these exempt facilities. At the university, housing privileges are not revoked without notice, without considerable administrative process. The process may include hearings and an appeals process to the Superior Court. Only on rare occasions do students insist on remaining in housing after their lease termination. Even then, significant efforts are made to avoid confrontation. SB 37, just would like to clarify the legislative intent versus the lower court's opinions. And any questions the committee may have, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, is there anyone else here who would like to testify on SB 137? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. I see no amendments. Senator Stevens, could we have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make the motion to move Senate Bill 137 from committee with individual recommendations.
Okay.
And attach fiscal notes.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. So 137 has moved on. I will note that we had folks from the University of Alaska here to answer questions, but I saw no questions.
Sir.
That brings us to Senate Bill 140, a ban on Internet spyware. And the roll-up sponsor is with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Stancliffe, staff to Senator Theriault. This bill was previously before the committee, and accompanying the bill was a presentation by Mr. Curtis Clothier outlining the magnitude of the problem and expense involved in dealing with spyware. Also, Mr. Ben Edelman from Harvard was online to, give the committee an idea how this legislation stacks up to other national models. We've had the benefit of 10 other states' work. We tried to incorporate the best features in this model, and Mr. Edelman felt that we had accomplished that objective. I'm here to try to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, if you should have any.
Thank you. Questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, is there anyone else here that in Juneau would like to testify on this bill? Jane, we don't have anyone on teleconference. Okay. Those that would like their computers to crash, please stand up. Seeing no other testimony, we'll close public testimony. I don't have any amendments. So, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, before you do that, I have a statement to make.
Oh, please do. I'm sorry, Senator Davis.
Not a problem. I just wanted to say that I had students to visit me yesterday that was down for the environmental summit that they held, And this is the one bill that one of the students in my district said she wanted to see passed because her computer was messed up with spyware.
Well,
and she told me to make sure that I passed this bill, so I'm glad to do that for her.
You can certainly affirm that you have moved that bill, helped move that bill forward. So a motion, hey, we had the motion, and Jane, please.
Senator Davis.
Yes.
Senator Stevens.
Yes.
Senator Mundy.
Yes. So Senate Bill 140 will be on its way to help that student's computer. That brings us to Senate Bill 2. And, oh, I was briefly at ease. We had And we have before us Senate Bill 2. We do have a CS that we'll need to adopt as our working document. It is /Y Yankee, dated 1-26-05. And Senator Stevens, if we could have a motion to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move committee substitute for Senate Bill 2, /Y, dated 1-26-05, to be considered as a working draft.
And I'll object for explanation. Senator Guest, would you like to speak to the CS, the changes in the CS?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Gretchen Guest. I'm state senator from District J. Before you is a CS for Senate Bill 2. The change between the CS and the original can be found on page 2, lines 17 through 19. It was at the request of the Department of Labor that we put in another exemption, which is their kind of wage claim and wage assignment process. And I can explain more of that when I explain the bill, if that's okay with you.
Any objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, we do have the CS before us, and Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee. Senate Bill 2 came from what I consider the best possible source for most legislation, which is constituents. I've had a couple constituent issues where false or frivolous liens have been placed on property, and in looking towards why this may or may not happen, found that with M&M liens, or in this case, often, or what right now required by law, all you have to do is really sign an affidavit. You don't have to show that you had any agreement with the owner of a property. So in the cases, in these constituent cases, it really was a disagreement between two people, and one party decides to go and file a lien on a property, and then the onus is on the owner to go down, take kind of the expense of both the time off and the legal recourse to try to undo the lien. So what I tried to do in this bill was balance both the importance of taking care of labor and laborers with the owners, and to say, and this is where you'll find in section 2, page 2, that when you file a lien on a property, you need to present either a contract or other documentation demonstrating that you have a contract or some type of agreement to do this work. If you don't have that, you can go to court and get a court order that shows the existence of a lien, or if you've gone through the Department of Labor, oftentimes when laborers do not receive the payment that they find due, they go to the Department of Labor. Department of Labor goes through a process that says, yes, you should have been paid, and that was the addition in the CS. Again, it was trying to find a balance between these two and the situation that, at least right now in the state, you don't really have to show any proof. Again, it's just an affidavit that you want to file a lien against the property. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Getz, yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 2, line 17, Senator Getz, it says a claim is wage claim or wage assignment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that boilerplate that they would that the Department of Labor would be able to go after the contractor for the assignments of a wage then?
And Mr. Mitchell is here, actually, from the Department of Labor. He might be able to answer. My understanding, it's their process to determine that a wage needs to be paid. So they do an investigation, and at the end of their investigation, they have a wage claim or a wage assignment. But he's here and maybe can speak more to that.
I'll wait.
Okay. My goal was just to have some type of process or something to try to stop the frivolous lien part, that someone's had to at least prove that they had a relationship, had a contract before they can place a lien on property.
All right, so I guess, if I might, Mr. Chairman, till the question I have is, if it's, I understand the position of the claimant's wage, of the laborer's or the claimant's wage, direct payment wage, but does this allow for the Department of Labor to go after a wage assignment that they may be collecting putting a lien against for a back payment that the department's trying to collect?
Why don't we ask Mr. Mitchell?
Yeah, through the chair.
Mr. Mitchell, when he comes up. Yeah.
Mr. Mitchell can answer that. That is not the intent. So
other
that's not how.
Other questions for
that.
Senator Guest. Seeing none, if we could excuse you, and we'll talk to Mr. Mitchell. Afternoon, Gray.
Gray Mitchell, Director of Labor Standards and Safety, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Just to answer Senator Stevens' question, Mr. Chairman, it's simply a terminology issue. A wage claim is the same thing as a wage assignment, essentially. And when the people at Legislative Legal were wrangling up the language, they just wanted to include both terms. So, you know, an assignment basically means that someone has assigned their wage claim to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, which means that we have the authority to act on their behalf. It's not, you know, where something would happen, you know, far removed from the actual filing of the claim, if that's what you're thinking.
If I might ask, in other words, if someone has child support payments that are in arrears, the Department of Labor wouldn't be the instrument in collecting via this language.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It would only be through wage claim assignments.
So garnishment would not be considered an assignment?
Mr. Chairman, that's true, Senator Stevens.
And I have a couple of questions, if I might. You know, we've heard the horror stories where somebody who's undercapitalized builds a building, doesn't pay the suppliers, leaves town, files bankruptcy, does something so he's not available to pay his bills, and then the supply company puts a lien on the home. Is there anything this bill would do to address that situation?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. It would require, as I understand it, and perhaps the sponsor would be better to answer this question since it's not really a labor-related question, but as I understand it, the supplier would have to come forward with some sort of a contract or a judgment to show that they were owed money in order to file the lien.
Well, one that's aimed, a question that's aimed a little more at specific labor than the contractor's bond is $10,000, I think, and that hasn't changed in quite a while. Would this be an appropriate time to discuss changing that bond? That might address my previous question if the bond was a larger bond.
Mr. Chairman, that'd be up to the committee.
Well, okay. That's something that we can consider when we bring the bill up again. Other questions for Mr. Mitchell? Hearing none, thank you very much. Don't forget your roll-up on the way out. Senator Guest, have you given any thought to the bond requirement and whether this might address the concern I expressed about builders who are undercapitalized and not living up to their responsibility, and so the homeowner ends up with a lien on their home?
Mr. Chair, I have not, but I'm more than willing to consider it. in this situation, they would have to show that they had an agreement with the property owner, not with the middle person, to be able to lien the property. And I'm not sure that that may take care of it, but I can give it some more thought and work on it and research the bond requirement and that situation.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. As is the practice of the committee, it's the first hearing, and we'll set it aside and bring it up again. Perhaps you could have a conversation with Jane, and we could talk about the bonding.
And, Mr. Chair, just for the record, so you know, and it's one of the reasons why I asked for the hearing to get postponed, I was able to meet with people from kind of the laborers community, make sure that they had no problems with the bill, and also with the home builders when they were here, and they don't have any problems with the bill either. I wanted to make sure if there were any amendments out there that they needed that we would bring them forth.
Appreciate that. Okay, thank you. We'll set this aside for further consideration. And that brings us to Senate Bill 1, the ever-popular Senate Bill 130. Mr. Lozanki or Commissioner, would you... Oh, never mind. I have my list. Let me go to Barbara Huff first because she was desperately trying to be two places at once last time we heard the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I am here today as a representative of the Alaska Labor Management Ad Hoc Committee, and I believe that we had a copy of this letter that hopefully is in the committee members' packets regarding
Bill
130. While I am not going to sit here and read this into the record since you all have a copy of it, the Ad Hoc Committee had asked that I at least come forward and address those out of the 13 items that we have, or at least 12, that we've raised concerns with regarding the particular bill. We did want to go on record, number one, at least recognizing that many of the items that the Ad Hoc Committee had presented in the Ad Hoc Committee Workers' Comp Bill actually have been adopted in Senate Bill 130. There are many other items that I would like to briefly talk about, just a few of them today on record, that have been included that we do have great concerns with. The first being the medical cost reimbursement issue. In Senate Bill 130, the administration is proposing to roll back the medical cost reimbursement rates to 1998 rate or 1999 rate. We do not believe that this is reasonable. Medical cost being the largest driving factor in workers' comp cost was actually one of the first items that the Ad Hoc Committee actually did look at, as were many of the items that are listed in or are included in our particular letter. We were not in a position, while we had requested information from both of the insurance companies regarding the medical cost, in November, as of this date, we still have not received that information. We did not have enough documented information to make a reasonable recommendation to be included in this workers' comp bill, and it was for that reason that we decided we would not address, we didn't have the information to address medical issues, and we deferred that until next year. We're very concerned that with the language that's been proposed in this bill, while it may be perceived by members of the business community as well as the legislative body to be a fix, while it may be short-term, from a long-term perspective, we're very concerned on the impact that it would have, not only with the medical community, in particular those physicians that may decide that they no longer wish to serve injured workers, but the long-term impact on injured workers as well. The second item that we addressed in our letter had to do with the ACOM, and these are guidelines that have been put together evidently in some areas of the country. Some states are actually utilized. Information that we've received recently, and this was another item that we did discuss in depth at our one of many of our ad hoc committee meetings over the months prior to legislative session starting. And the conclusion that we reached with respect to the guidelines was the same regarding the medical cost. We needed more information. I think probably some information that we would be able to possibly feed to you, Mr. Chairman, for the information of the rest of the committee members, just looking at the state of California and some of the major problems that they're dealing with their recent changes with workers' comp system and the implementation of the ACOM guidelines. What little information we've received at this particular point in time, there's some major issues with how the insurance companies are actually applying these guidelines and those medical services that are actually being denied because they're either not clearly defined in the guidelines or they're not addressed in the guidelines at all, so therefore you're not entitled to any services. So again, this was another area that we did look at in the ad hoc committee process, not having the information that we believed was adequate to make any kind of recommendation. It was another item that we deferred, but definitely did want to continue to look at. On the second page of the letter, the third item was voc rehab. Again, this was another area that the ad hoc committee had looked at, a huge cost factor within the workers' comp system. But to take, and we had probably three or four meetings that we discussed. We brought in some of the voc rehab representatives to give us a better idea in general how that system works. We talked about even taking that voc rehab, maybe we turn it in instead of voc rehab, we turn it into a return-to-work program, utilizing some of those existing staff people within the state and then reorganizing in the private sector. From our perspective, again, not having the information available to us to propose to either wipe out or to drastically change voc rehab, which would have a significant impact on private sector businesses out there. It, again, was another item that we did defer until such time as we had enough information to make some legit recommendations that would have a long-term benefit to both the injured workers as well as the business community throughout the state. Item number four addresses the return to work, and I mentioned that in conjunction with the voc rehab. We had actually talked about the return to work program when we were looking at proposing to delete the second injury fund. We did not believe that the second injury fund, as currently constituted in statute, necessarily services the employer and or the utilization for injured workers out there. But first and foremost, we really truly believe that you do need to have a responsive return to work program once these people are injured to get them back to work.
And can I interrupt to ask you to flesh that out a little bit as to how you envision a return to work program? Someone's rehabilitated, they're healthy, they then apply for a job and either go back to their original or, if they can't, another field. When you say return to work, are you talking about, I mean, that's something beyond rehabilitation, so how do you envision that?
Well, in some states, they actually have a formal return to work, which was what we wanted to look at in those states that have a program. We have some employers within the state of Alaska that have established within their own corporate structure a return to work or a modified work program. While they may not be able to perform to the full capacity all of those particular job duties, in some organizations they're actually large enough where they could do modified work or work of a lesser degree in other areas without running the risk of further injury or creating new injuries. And some states have actually formalized those types of programs in conjunction with their workers' comp programs.
Thank you.
Item number five deals with, and I think this was an area that surprised some folks, and it was not something that was discussed at the ad hoc committee process at all. In fact, our charge when we sat down at the table as an ad hoc committee was to take a look at the workers' comp program and see where we could actually save some cost. This was not an area that we looked at. This has been proposed by the administration We've not had a lot of discussion since the bill's been introduced regarding this area, but there is some concern that this would actually increase cost to the workers' comp program, even though it does address hiring attorneys to represent the injured workers. Now, some would say that as long as the injured worker has an attorney and the particular company that they were actually working for or a representative for that company is also represented, that supposedly they will have a quicker settlement of some of these workers' comp claims. We've not seen any statistical information that would prove that one way or the other. We included it in our letter because we are concerned that it actually would increase, not decrease cost out there. The next item that I did want to touch on, while rather briefly, it was an issue that was addressed in legislation that was introduced by the administration last year, both in regular session as well as special session, and that's dealing with the commission and the de novo review. Under the proposal, and somewhat similar in this bill, is to take, again, this panel, get rid of the superior court, replace them with this new layer of bureaucracy, and to give this particular group of individuals the power de novo review, where they could actually take a case and completely rehear it. We have concerns. We've continued to have concerns with that. The ad hoc committee did come up with what we thought was a less costly and we felt addressed some of the same concerns, or at least the direction that the administration was looking at going in addressing continuity of court case or board decisions prior to it going to Superior Court. Under the ad hoc committee language, this particular would be basically a super senior workers' comp board. To labor, to management, with an workers' comp hearing officer that would sit. They would hear these particular appeals of decisions from the workers' comp board and would have the ability to decide those questions limited to specific issues of law. We felt that this was a compromise. It did not add on additional people. We would continue to utilize those existing workers' comp board members that have already been appointed by the governor, approved by the legislative body, and that these senior members of the workers' comp board would actually bring to the table that knowledge of the law and would indeed follow what the intent of the statutes as they relate to workers' comp actually addressed out there without adding the additional cost to the bureaucracy. The other item, and I don't know that we need to necessarily go through all of those, but I think
we'd like to talk about your fraud suggestion.
Which one?
Item 7.
Number 7. Oh.
The fraud statute.
We were actually a little surprised by this. The response that we've received since we raised this, we do not believe that the fraud language in the administration's bill actually goes far enough. And one of our big concerns, and there were several individuals that have had personal experience either through their particular business or in the case of even on labor side where they have had members injured, and indeed there were some accusations with followed up proof, but the department never ever followed up and pressed any of these charges. So when we were looking at this particular section, we believe that this is an area that can, if it does not necessarily save a lot of money, the message going out there that if indeed you are involved or even considering a fraudulent act under workers' comp, that these folks would at least step back and reconsider. And that theoretically would help save money in the system. We believe that the language that we proposed in the ad hoc bill was actually much stronger than what the administration was proposing in Senate Bill 130. And I believe we did attach that language.
You've got the language there. It's just a little reversal of roles, and I was interested in hearing a little more about it. I mean, that's probably not a fair way to state that. I didn't mean to indicate that you were encouraging fraud. It's that asking for greater enforcement rather than less is not something we usually hear.
Well, and actually, if I might just briefly respond to that, I think it was indicative of the process that the ad hoc committee went through. While it was the committee was made up of labor and management, it was not what I would define as a traditional negotiations. We put something on the table and then we bargain over what we ultimately ended up with. We truly utilized, I guess, through our committee, our hearings, and inviting folks to come in and share information. And then we had open discussion about, okay, this is the issue. More of a traditional, a non-traditional negotiations, and probably more in line with an interest-based bargaining, where we talk about what the issue is and figure out what the best right answer is to address that, both long-term as well as short-term. I did want to mention just briefly, and I don't know how familiar, the temporary seasonal definition. While we do believe that it probably affects employers around the state, probably the biggest area that's impacted is actually construction work. And we did spend some time in this particular section. This is item number 8 of our letter addressing this. We had proposed some language in our ad hoc committee letter that we felt adequately addressed it and was fair for the injured worker as well as the business aspect and what those impacts were long term. And I think pretty much everything else in our letter, Mr. Chairman, is probably somewhat self-explanatory. The second injury fund, we do believe that it probably should be phased out and maybe tying something else in with that. And we look forward to working with the committee and hopefully with the administration to come up with some sort of a bill. That was our goal, at least from the ad hoc committee's perspective, to come up with a bill. While we're not going to be able to fix all of the wrongs of the world, at least it was a step in the right direction. At least it was sending a message to business, as well as to the injured workers, that we need to do something. And we really did believe that at least the ad hoc committee bill was a step in the right direction. And hopefully the concerns that we've raised with respect to Senate Bill 130 will be looked at by the committee and addressed accordingly.
Well, on behalf of the committee, we certainly appreciate and thank you for the suggestions. Too often it's easy to say we disagree, but not having then an alternative or a positive proposal. So we really appreciate that, and the committee will take your suggestions seriously. Well, in just a moment, in case there are questions. No, I guess we don't. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lozanke. You have opening comments to share as we begin?
For the record, my name is Paul F. Lozanke. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And, Mr. Chairman, I really don't have any.
Okay, thank
remarks.
You.
I don't know if...
the reason I called you up is to ask that, and I don't want you to speak off the top of your head, but do you have a copy of the ad hoc letter?
Yes, Commissioner, I believe I have one before me, and they were good enough to send me an advance copy as well, so I've seen it for a while.
Item number 7 about the fraud statutes, I would be very interested in having you and the department take a look at that suggestion and then get back to me as to your reactions. And
yes, sir.
And I guess I'd like to know more about the return to work issue, if you've explored what other states have done, and if we could learn from their successes and their mistakes.
Yes, sir.
Question. Senator Davis has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to know on item number 6. the committee that you want to set up rather than going through the courts. Could you tell me if you have looked at other states' workers' comps and see if they have such a committee as this?
Senator Davis, through the chair, we have, over the course of the last year or so, looked at a good number of the statutes in various states, and there are a goodly number, I can't tell you exactly how many, there are a goodly number of states that do have an executive branch committee that hears appeals of workers' compensation matters. I'm not sure if there are any that have precisely the type of the proposal that the ad hoc committee recommendation envisioned. That proposal is more of a reconsideration by a different group of the same board that made the original decision, as opposed to sending it to a separate entity like an appeals commission. But both would end up with some degree of review within the executive branch. The major difference is under SB 130, the appeals commission would take the place of the superior court, and we believe would be, among other things, somewhat quicker. The one thing about the proposal from the ad hoc committee to have a senior board panel be the consistency arbiter, if you will, is that that would be an add-on to the current appeal system and would maintain the current appeal system. So it would, although I would imagine that senior panel could act relatively quickly, that would be additional time, conceivably, in the overall appeals process.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lozanke. Kevin, would you like to testify? Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Smith, the Executive Director for the Alaska Municipal League's Joint Insurance Association. The AMLJIA, we'll call it that because it's shorter than Alaska Municipal League Joint Insurance Association, the AMLJIA represents 140 municipalities and school districts in the state of Alaska. It's organized under Alaska Statute 2176. What that does is it permits these public entities to self-insure as a group when they may not have the resources to self-insure as individual entities. As far as risk financing mechanisms go, being able to self-insure as a group is a fairly efficient way to do this. Essentially to pay the cost of losses and pay the cost of reinsurance and pay the cost of overhead, that's about what goes into calculating rates. So there's no shareholder profit necessary as you'd get in a commercial insurance arrangement. The AMLJIA has a $300,000 self-insured retention. So for every workers' compensation loss that we have to fund enough to cover at least the first $300, or $300,000 rather, of the loss. Above and beyond that, we purchase reinsurance or insurance for insurance companies to make sure that if somebody's seriously injured, that there's adequate resources to cover it. But despite the efficiencies of the system itself, the costs continue to rise for the public sector in Alaska, just as they've risen for the private sector in Alaska. And the workers' compensation system, from our perspective, is broken and needs to be fixed. The costs have gotten to a point where a number of municipalities can't afford to purchase the insurance anymore. With the PERS-TERS problems that are on their plate, lack of municipal assistance in revenue sharing, increased fuel costs, utility costs, the increased demands essentially on the public coffers with less resources have forced me to cancel at least 10 municipalities in December from coverage for workers' comp, for property, and for liability, and have had canceled several more since then. That doesn't mean they're all canceled at this moment. Some have been able to come on together, find their resources. It's kind of a moving target, find the resources to get back into the program. But it's a serious situation. I think that Senate Bill 130 is a step in the right direction for helping contain increasing costs in workers' compensation. In particular, some of the positives of the program that are proposed here that I like are the ability to settle to stipulate to agreements when both parties are represented without having to go get board approval. Streamlining the voc rehab process, I think, is a good idea. The medical cost stuff, particularly a preferred provider list for the employers, voluntary for employees, but the ability to try to negotiate some costs, I think, is a good thing. Generic drugs is a good thing. Guidelines for medical care, I think, is a positive step. As a public employer, some offset for PERS-TERS or OCC disability, I think, is a great idea. And the phasing out of the second injury fund, I think, is long overdue. So with that, I'll answer any questions, if there are any. And other than that, I thank you for your time.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. The public entities that are now going bare without workers' comp, are they then trying to self-insure? What are they doing, or are they breaking state law?
I think that some of them are bending state law, and most of them are scrambling to try to find the resources to get back into the program. But you know, they have to get in line. They have to satisfy the IRS. They have to be able to make payroll, these sort of things. It's kind of where it's at.
Obviously, as Walmart or Fred Meyer's or something are going bare, we probably would have some serious heartburn about that, and I think it may trickle down then to communities. So,
well, a number of those communities, I think, have gotten to a point where there's not a lot of employees to worry about getting hurt. It's they're essentially going through the same sort of situation that Lamex had to, which is they've basically had to close their doors and toss the keys to the tribal entities in their organizations, so that there's less apt to have employees get hurt when you can't afford, when there's no employees to have.
Well, and even a few employees, it reminds me of the old saw about a minor operation. That's one that happens to somebody else. If I'm the only employee and I get hurt, it's still a major.
Absolutely. Definitely. It's a serious situation.
Questions for Mr. Smith? See any? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on Senate Bill 130? Seeing none, we obviously do have a few issues to deal with. The good news, I think, is, as I think Kevin's testimony reflected, I don't think there's anybody happy with the current system. Now, we may not agree about what the solution is, but I think we all agree we need a solution, and that gives me hope that we can untie the Gordian knot and perhaps find something that at least makes everybody just a little bit mad. So if we have no further business to come before the committee, with special thanks to committee members who are here today and staffers, we will stand adjourned. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner, did you have anything you'd like to add before we leave? You hadn't signed up, but I...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I recognize your presence and participation.
I wanted to be sure that I was recognized because we're following this bill very closely. For the record, I am the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Greg O'Clary, and I just wanted to thank you for your hours and hours of listening to testimony. Our bill is not perfect. We should have a sign, I think, hanging in front of this bill that says construction zone, work in progress. But I know we're going to get there. I know that the people of Alaska that depend on this particular system and body of law require attention this year. And thank you for your help and support in putting a bill together that works for all of Alaska.
Well, and we certainly thank you. Appreciate it. That I'm not hearing from anyone, my way or the highway, that this is a cooperative venture. All right. Well, next week, I hope we will have a siesta review on Senate Bill 130, and then I think it would be time for us to finish our work and move it on. It's my understanding that it will have a referral to the Judiciary Committee after it leaves here to address a couple of legal issues, and then it's at least this chair's intent, and I think I speak for others, to move this bill toward floor action. So we also on next Tuesday will take, in addition to other public testimony on SB 130, SB 147, sport fishing facility revenue bonds, and SJR 11, the repeal of the telecommunications tax. So again, with thanks to all, we will stand adjourned. Don't forget your roll-up on the way out.